And present today we have Co-Chair Johnston and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And then online, I see Representative LeBon is online. And if any other legislator is online, I'm not seeing anybody else there, but if they are, please feel free to let us know. And I'll keep an eye on the iPad here as folks check in.
Mr. Chair.
This is Representative Wall.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Okay, we've got Representative Sullivan Leonard, and I heard Representative Wool.
Yes, Representative Wool's here, too.
Okay.
And Representative Tilton.
And Representative Tilton is online.
Carpenter's here.
And was that, I'm sorry, who is that?
Carpenter is here.
Oh, thank you. Representative Carpenter is online. And
Josephson.
Representative Josephson is online. And
Ortiz.
Representative Merrick.
Representative Ortiz and Representative Merrick. Great. Okay, looks like we have just about everybody. And so with that, today the committee will hear a presentation from Pat Whitney, Director of Legislative Finance, and Megan Wallace, Director of Legislative Legal Services. And the topic of the meeting will be focused around the federal funding that will be coming to Alaska with the passage of the CARES Act. And so let's see, we've got pretty much everybody, almost everybody online. If we could maybe let the presenters work through their presentations fully, and then at the end we can take questions. And so I guess before we start, are there any questions for Representative Johnston?
Yes, Mr. Chair, maybe it would be a good idea for folks online to put their phones on mute until after the presentation.
Thank you. And that's thank you for that, Representative Johnston. And if there is nothing else, we will jump right into it. Ms. Pitney and Ms. Wallace, are you both online?
This is Pat Pitney, Director of Legislative Finance.
Hi, Megan Wallace, Director of Legal Services, also online.
Great, thank you. And with that, I believe that hit me. If you could go ahead and kind of walk us through, you provided a nice 16-page a summary of what's out there, and if you could go through that and anything else that you might have. I believe you have also got a presentation as well, a PowerPoint. So if you could take it away.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, Pat Pitney, Director of Legislative Finance. Yes, there's two documents available on BASIS. One is the Federal CARES Act summary presentation, and it's a 12-page PowerPoint document. And the other document is the summary document that goes through all of the, or many of the provisions in the CARES Act, and has more detail, but I use the presentation as an outline. The CARES Act is very comprehensive. It is a $2 trillion piece of federal legislation. I want to thank Michael Partlow, who's also on the line, for putting together the summary document of that federal legislation. The document, the summary document, is categorized in four sections. The federal funds that are going to come through existing state programs, and that the state will receive them directly, either existing state programs or money that the state will receive directly. The second category are the funds that will go directly to non-state entities. So that could be tribal entities, local governments, hospitals, child care facilities, et cetera. The third category are federal funds that go to federal agencies who then will administer additional grant programs. And the last category in the document is general items of interest. So this presentation, I'm going to go from the in reverse order, and I'm going to start with the items of general interest.
Can Ms. Pitten, I'm sorry, this presentation, just anybody who might be online and watching, if they want to follow along and have access to this PowerPoint, I believe, to your knowledge, it's on the legislature's webpage, is that correct?
Yes.
That's right. Okay.
It is on BASIS for this. So if you're on the legislative website and then connect to the meetings, and within the Finance Committee meeting, there will be documents associated with it.
Okay. And the basis is that I think if folks just Google Alaska Legislature and then a basis, and then they should be able to go to the finance from there, and I think folks can find it from there. I also would like to recognize that we're joined by Speaker of the House, Bryce Edgman. And so with that, please continue, Ms. Pitten.
Okay. So there's a few items of general interest within the CARES Act. One is the extension of the Real ID deadline from this October to September 30, 2021. The other is a provision that I think many people are hearing in the news, especially today. It's the direct payment to individuals of up to $1,200 per adult, $2,400 per couple, and $500 for dependent children. There is an income threshold that's tied to that, so over $75,000 the funding reduces and I think stops at somewhere about $99,000 in annual income. But this, you know, those who are taxpayers who had direct deposit, this money will show up directly in their account. And other provisions are the Small Business Development Center has many, many small business loan and business grant provisions. And the most important one probably is the $10,000 emergency grant. And this is just a holdover grant. It doesn't have to be paid back, so if you're a small business, that's important. There's also loans that can cover up, that can be acquired, but then can turn into a grant that would cover personnel costs, rents, mortgage, and utility costs. So there's also provisions for tax credits for participating businesses. The University Small Business Development Center is the main resource for these small business loans, and if you're already a loan recipient, your bank also is a good resource. There's $75 million for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for grants to public television and radio stations. And the CARES Act requires health plans to cover COVID-19 testing. So the next category is federal funds in the CARES Act allocated to federal agencies for different grant programs. So, and I'm on page 4 of the presentation. So there are two associated with funding for public health agencies. This is for grants and or cooperative agreements. There's $4.3 billion for prevention, preparedness, and response to the COVID-19 virus, and this covers things like personal protection equipment, laboratory testing, technology infrastructure to address you know, telehealth or and expansion of facilities as necessary. Within that $4.3 billion, it's $1.5 billion to carry out surveillance and epidemiology, surveillance, communication, and other activities. Within that, there's $125 million set aside for tribes. There's $400 million set aside for election security grants, and this is for focused on the 2020 federal election cycle, and that's available for all states, knowing that states are going to have to or may have to change how elections are handled. The next two are community development block grants and community service block grants, and it's $5 billion and $1 billion. These are ongoing established programs, and these potentially might come through the state process, through commerce, but likely could go to directly to current grant recipients. The community services block grant, the $1 billion, is to implement anti-poverty programs. There's two different HUD programs, housing and urban development, one for $2 billion and one for $4 billion. So one is for existing grantees, and then another is for homeless assistance grants. There's three programs associated with hospitals, $250 million for grants and cooperative agreements, with grantees or sub-grantees of hospital preparedness programs, $100 billion for grants to hospitals and nonprofits, as well as suppliers to help cover unreimbursable health care costs related to expenses or lost revenue as a result of COVID-19. So, probably that's very important for the hospitals in our state. There's another $275 million for cooperative agreements and grants to expand services and capacity in rural hospitals, also probably a very important feature for rural hospitals in our state. Moving on to page 5, additional grant programs are through the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So there's $425 million for certified community behavioral health clinics, and another $250 million for expansion of existing grant programs. $50 million of that is allocated to suicide prevention. There's $100 million in grants for pilot programs for rural broadband access, for another $25 million for distance learning and telemedicine could be useful for communities in Alaska. There's $10 billion in airport improvement programs, and really this money is to make sure that existing airports stay open. There's $100 million in funding for safe schools and citizen education, and then there's another $45 million in grants to support child welfare and families during crisis. So page 6 is another page of federal funds to federal agencies for grants, and the first three on this page are for assisted living in some way, shape, or form. There's $10 million for continuation of existing congregate service grants for residents of assisted housing projects. There's $955 million for the Administration for Community Living, and this is for seniors and disabled individuals, as well as their caregivers. Excuse me. And then there's $85 million for independent learning centers, for independent living centers. Another $25 million for telehealth networks and response centers, and $150 million in grants for construction of state extended care facilities. $14.4 billion in Veterans Administration programs for health care for homeless veterans. And last, among the federal funds to federal agencies for grants is $850 million for the BRIN-JAG program. And these funds would allow state and local police departments and jails to meet local needs. So moving on, page 7 and page 8 are almost identical, so we're going to skip page 7. Cut and paste error there. And move on to page 8. So page 8 covers federal funds that will go directly to non-state entities. So this will be local governments, tribal governments, or medical or hospital facilities. So $750 million is slated to go to Head Start programs, and we have several Head Start programs throughout the state. The state in the past has provided the local area match for the Head Start programs. This money comes without the match requirement and is available for summer programs as well. There's $25 billion for transit systems, so local communities and some tribal entities have transit systems, and this money will go on some formula basis out to those entities. There's $453 million for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. This is for public safety, justice programs, welfare assistance, and social services programs, and other tribal government assistance. Indian Health Service has over $1 billion for public health support, electronic records. $65 million of the funding will be used for electronic health records, and $450 million will be distributed to IHS facilities. IHS-operated facilities. There's $100 million set aside for food distribution programs on Indian reservations. All of the Alaska tribes are eligible to administer this food distribution program. There's also $8 billion of the Corona Relief Fund that's set aside for tribal governments for expenses based on COVID-19. Okay, moving on to page 9. These programs now are the federal programs that will go to the state directly, and I want to remind people that the dollar figures that I'm providing, this is the amount of money in the bill for the nation, and Alaska will get a piece of that depending on the formula basis that they use to cover it. So the first two, I'm on page 9. The first two are around the Disaster Relief Fund and National Guard deployment. There's $45 billion. For the Disaster Relief Fund for immediate needs, and $1.4 billion for deployments of National Guards. There's expanded unemployment insurance. from 3 to 4 months, and this is additive to the state's current unemployment system, and it's a adds $600 a month to the $390 a month, $370 a month that Alaska already has. I'm sorry, $600 a week. That's on top of the either $370 a week or $390 a week that Alaska's unemployment insurance maximum is. And how this, what this really accomplishes is it is 100% wage replacement for someone who's making $60,000 a year. In addition to covering traditional unemployment insurance eligible employees, they have expanded the program to also cover those individuals on the gig economy who weren't traditionally unemployment insurance eligible, so people like Uber drivers or self-employed contractors. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development is working diligently on the application procedures and the distribution procedures to make sure this money flows as quickly as possible. For businesses, cities, and states. This particular item is really low interest loans from the federal government, and it'd be eligible for the state to apply for, and this could be something that could, for instance, cover PERSNTERS, could be used to have a larger PERSNTERS deposit. There's money available for continuation of essential air service in rural communities. The next three are all related to the state's current food programs that are also, that have always been federally funded, and $8.8 billion nationally is available through September 2021. It includes money for SNAP, which is the money that people might recognize as WIC, Women in Crisis. But together, those funds are significant: $8.8 billion, $450 million, $15.5 billion. I'd mentioned the community services block grants previously. We're not sure if that's going to come through the state or through grantees directly. There's $900 million for the LIHEAP program. This is support for low-income and disabled and elderly population to pay for heating assistance. This is a program that currently exists in the state, and this would expand that benefit to those in need. So moving on to page 10, these next two are kind of current on top of mind that are soon to be distributed. The first is there's over $30 billion for the Education Stabilization Fund. And this is for state school districts and institutions of higher learning. $3 billion of that $30 billion goes to governors to allocate at their discretion for emergency support grants. Then $13.2 billion is available for K-12 education. And most of this funding will be distributed based on the number of students and the number of students that are Title I eligible or low-income eligible. Also, for the funds that are received in Alaska out of this $3.2 billion and Michael can probably tell us the estimated amount, of the funds received, 99% is going to go to school districts, 99.5%. There's a small administrative fee to distribute it to the each local education area. The $14 billion for emergency relief for the institutions of higher education, the estimate for Alaska is in the range of $10 million, of which about $7.5 million is for the University of Alaska. Of that money, much of it is requested to be, or is required to be sent to students. And the formula that they've used to base that on largely is on Pell Grant eligible enrollment, which is low income students. But a lot of, half of that money is set aside to go to students directly to help them manage expenses through this time. So now the last item, which is kind of the item of most interest, is the $150 billion coronavirus relief fund for states, local, and tribal governments. And their goal is to pay it out within 30 days of enactment of the bill. The word we are hearing is that that funding will be distributed by the 24th of April. Alaska is one of the 18 states who get the minimum of $1.25 billion. The $1.25 billion in other state or states with municipalities with 500,000 population or more would have money set aside for municipalities. Because Alaska does not have a population center of 500,000 or more, it is expected that Alaska will, the state will receive the whole 1.25 and then manage the distribution to communities. The 45% of the total 1.25 in the federal legislation was kind of categorized for local communities. On page 11 is the guidance we have thus far on the, how the Corona Relief Funding could be used. And there are three three pieces of guidance in the current bill. We are anticipating that the Treasury Department will be sending additional guidance any day. I've heard anywhere between the 14th and the 17th, and we've not yet seen it, the additional guidance yet. But the first I'll just read it. It'll be easier. The Corona Relief Fund can only be used to cover expenses that, one, are necessary expenditures incurred due to the public health emergency with respect to the coronavirus disease 2019, so COVID-19. Number two, were not accounted for in the budget most recently approved as of March 27, 2020, the date of enactment of the CARES Act. And three, were incurred during the period that begins on March 1, 2020, and ends December 30, 2020. So the guidance we've received both in from telephone conversations with federal officials thus far is it's for costs associated with the COVID-19 outbreak from the date of March 1 through December 2020. So with that, I can take questions and then turn it over to Megan to talk about kind of the process to receive the additional federal funds and the legislature's role in that.
Thank you, Ms. Pitney. I'd also like to recognize that we were joined by Representative Sarah Hannon down in Juneau. Thanks for joining us. Is there anybody else who's joined us online who I don't see on my iPad here? I don't hear anybody. So with that, let's go to questions for Ms. Pitney. So first of all, we've got Representative Johnston, Vice Chair Johnston, and then if anybody has any questions, feel free to jump right in there. Representative Johnston.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I think I have multiple principal questions here, but maybe if we go to page 10, this will set it up for my other questions in previous pages. So in page 10, the Education Stabilization Fund, my first question is, do we already have the appropriating vehicles to be able to accept those funds? And is it something that is not addressed in either our mental health budget, our operating budget, or SB 241 as far as receipt authority? And just to be a little bit more clarifying, what I'm trying to find out throughout this budget is what items will the legislature in some process need to give receipt authority to, and then what items that are on this list are, do we not have any appropriating vehicle? But the education one to me seems like you already have a formula in place. Is that correct?
The formula in place is set up by the federal government, but both the Department of Education and Early Development and the university have existing federal appropriations. To the degree that this amount of money exceeds their federal receipt authority, is would then require some action. But at least within the education area, depending on the use of the funds, there are currently federal appropriations that exist that could potentially be increased through the RPL process. But I think really that is the piece that Megan's going to cover, and it might be better to wait for Megan to cover that before we address these one by one, because Megan will cover all kind of the range of type of action that might be necessary.
Right, and I understand, Pat, as far as that. I'm just trying to sort of get clarification in just our budget process before we go to the legal process. And you don't need to answer this now, but it would be helpful as far as the block grants, if all of those block grants go through the state to the municipalities and the communities. This is not tribal, but the block grants themselves. Or do some communities actually apply to it directly to the federal government so we again know where our responsibilities are? Thank you.
So the block grants, that is a good question. We'll have to get back to you on that. There are some pieces of the block grants that come through the state, and there are, as we understand it, some that are direct to communities. Things like that $25 million in the transit system, those go directly to the communities that operate the transit
system. Right, and a follow-up, and just to thank you for that, as we go forward and try to be thoughtful on how we approach this, it will be helpful to understand where funding from the CARES Act is already in place, and so we know that we're addressing the needs properly. Thank you.
And do we have any other questions of Ms. Pitney from anybody on the committee?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yeah. I could use some clarification on any number of things, but I guess this is sort of for Ms. Pitney and sort of for Ms. Wallace, but in Ms. Wallace's legal memo, she says at page 2 that emergency funding cannot be used to supplement existing budget items that are unrelated to the emergency. And I guess the first thing that I'm learning in the middle of page 2 of that memo is that the measure or the lens that we look through is not the recently vetoed budget, but really more the budgets, plural, that would be HB 39 and HB 2001 that were passed last year. And so when we're looking to see whether something is COVID-related and addressed in a budget, it's those budgets that we look to. Am I right about that?
Yes. It's expenses above those, above the budgets that were enacted at the time that the CARES Act was enacted. So the 21 operating budget and the supplemental, the 20 fast track supplemental HB 234 were enacted shortly after the enactment of the CARES Act. But I think it might be better to have Megan go and set that stage before, because the questions kind of seem to connect these two topics, and I think it might be better to have Megan.
Okay. But sticking, Mr. Chairman, if I could, sticking with Ms. Pitney on another question.
Yes, Representative Josephson.
Relative to the $1.25 billion, which is sort of the hot topic, it seems to me that although that should absolutely be a focus, that we have to be nuanced and continually looking at all these other items in the PowerPoint we've just gone through. That and we're going to need some real education on the RPL process relative to all of those other funding sources beyond the $1.25 billion. So am I right about that, that while the $1.25 billion is critical, there's all these other monies that are out there?
Correct. Those monies that are in federal agencies that are available in grants that could come through the state, those would also be important to know, to what degree we have the existing program from which to, to accept the dollars and then to, implement those dollars for the cause. But there's, but to the degree it's an extension of existing program, federal program that's already in place, for instance, TANF, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that particular program is already in place, and to the degree that this particular program exceeds the federal authority amount, that could be an RPL. And so, yeah, it really depends on it. And I think, again, I think we're touching the two pieces of this, and that, and the range of options that Ms. Wallace will discuss, I think, will help frame it, and then we can talk specific questions.
Yeah, and if we could maybe set aside the $1.25 billion for now, set aside any legal questions, and set aside the RPL process, and we'll get through Megan Wallace's discussion, and then we can move to those. But does anybody have any questions on any of the other programs that were outlined in Ms. Pitney's PowerPoints, any of the programs that are out there? Any questions on any of those?
I have a question, Neil. This is Rep. Wall.
Rep. Wall, good.
The $600 per week, Pat, you said that was to compensate for a $60,000 a year job. Mm-hmm. So that would imply that unemployment insurance would pay another $600 to equal $1,200 per week. I mean, Alaska doesn't, I believe, come close to $600 a week in UI, even if it's maxed, unless I guess you have 10 kids or something. So is that accurate to try to reach the $60,000 a year salary? I don't see how those numbers add up.
So if you were making $60,000 a year before you lost your job, the $600 additional federal payment per week plus Alaska's existing $370 or $390 a week would replace the wage consistent with somebody making $60,000 a year. If you were making more than $60,000 a year, the UI insurance does not completely replace your wages lost. If you're making $60,000 or less, Alaska's unemployment insurance plus the $600 a week from the feds would replace that wage.
Okay. Okay. I guess by your math, it looks like $600 plus $400, which is $1,000 a week, which is $52,000 a year. But, I'm not...
And I think we're looking at the additional for kids if you're a family of four.
Okay, thanks. And do you know how many people will apply for that $600 for UI and the additional $600? I mean, obviously, it's not everybody in the state. So do you guys have an estimate based on current trajectory of applicants?
Through the chair, Representative, we're getting updates from Department of Labor on a weekly basis, and they're up significantly from last year. I think as of the end of March, new applicants were 11,000, and ongoing were something like 15,000. I don't quote me on those numbers. We can provide them after to the committee after this. But there's anybody who applies is automatically eligible for the $600.
Okay.
In addition to whatever the Alaska component is. The system isn't yet set up that they're receiving those payments, though. But as soon as the system is set up to get the payment, anybody who has applied, who's eligible, will receive it.
Okay, thank you. And follow-up, separate question, I guess. The Education Stabilization Fund, $30 billion, and it looks like Alaska's going to get $10 million, approximately, and university is $7.5 million, although much of that is going to students directly. Does the university, we're told they're going to, like many institutions, suffer a great loss due to COVID. Is there any other fund that will help the university as a whole besides the individual students that other areas, maybe the Education Stabilization Fund or another fund?
So the $10 million that's coming to the state associated with higher education, of that $7.5 million is roughly the estimate for the University of Alaska. And then there's, you know, like the Charter College gets some. There's a Bible College in Kenai that gets some. So there's other universities that receive funds. So the portion that isn't sent to the students then is available, but that is not large. And as I do not know of other funds available to help cover the other losses at the university.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Do we have any other questions regarding the programs here? Hearing none.
This is Representative Ortiz. I have a question.
Representative Ortiz, go ahead.
Going to slide 10 or page 10 and referring to the hold on. Give me 1 second. Go ahead and somebody else step forward. I've lost my place. I think somebody else had a question as well.
Sure.
Yes, this Rep. LeBond, could I get in?
Sure, Rep. LeBond, go ahead.
Yes, the question is regarding support for hospitals. On slide 4, $100 billion for grants to hospitals, et cetera. Do we know how those funds are going to be distributed throughout the state for medical facilities?
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, those are grants that are managed by CMS or some other federal health and social services entity, and it would be the hospitals working directly with that federal agency to secure those funds. It wouldn't be the hospital working with the state and the state's working with the feds. So that's in that category of money available as grants from the federal government.
Okay, thank you.
Great. And Representative Ortiz?
Yes. I'm trying to get to the page where, where my question originates, and I can't seem to find it, but perhaps Pat will remember the page. It has to do with the potential monies to businesses who have been forced to shut down, and in this particular case, individual contractors that may work for those businesses, and how they could get some relief. And it was described as a loan program, but then I've heard in passing that perhaps the loans would be forgiven. So that's what my question references, and I'm trying to remember. I think it was the amount of, I can't remember how much money was there, but in any case, I'm wondering whether it's up to the individual business to apply for that directly with the federal government, or is that something that they apply for in relationship to DOL, Department of Labor, the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, you're referring to the Small Business Administration. There's an emergency grant of $10,000. Then there's loans of which for sure.
And can you tell me what page we're talking about when we're referring to what I'm referring to? Because I'm still trying to find that. I had it at one point, but
on the presentation, it is on page 3.
Okay.
In the overall document, it's going to be the last page, page 16. So the best resource to understand how to apply for a Small Business Administration loan if you don't already have one, is there is the Small Business Development Center at the university. It's been there as long as I've been associated, with the university, so since at least 1991, if not longer. And it is a resource specifically set up to help link small businesses with the Small Business Administration Center. any small business who has already received an SBA loan in the past, these are loans that go through a bank. They would want to go talk to their bank. And so there's three provisions. One is the $10,000 emergency grant, and truly just a grant. Then there's a loan, a short-term loan, for which payroll, mortgage, utilities could be forgiven for the short term. And then there's another slightly different provision on a loan where you could get the loan paid back through future tax credits.
Mr. Chairman, could I jump in a little bit here? This Rep. LeBron.
Sure, Rep. LeBron.
Yeah. To follow up with Ms. Pitney's comments, and she's correct, there's several programs. The $10,000 max program is a direct loan application to the Small Business Administration. The banks don't manage that program. However, the banks do manage the Paycheck Protection Program, and I've been putting some time in at my former employer at the bank here, helping the bank process the Payment Protection Program loans. We're up to over 250 loans and over $30 million in the hopper under this program. The repayment term is 2 years. There's interest only for 6 months. And if the business uses the majority of the money for payroll-related expenses, there's the opportunity to get that amount forgiven. But as Pat said, you can use it for utilities and rent and other purposes, but I think your focus should be on keeping folks on payroll during the next several months. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, and just one final follow-up question, and those comments were helpful both from Pat and from Representative LeBond, so thank you very much. But my specific question, though I finally found it, was related to page 9, and it's $500 billion economic stabilization lending for fund for businesses, cities, and states. Is that the same amount of money that we're talking about or the same programs we're talking about in our just in our recent discussion that Rep. LeBond and Pat spoke about?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that is completely different.
Okay. Okay.
That's really a major debt refinancing mechanism.
Okay.
For states and cities and others. So if you and it is utilizing low interest loans from,
okay.
And loans is used loosely.
Okay.
The low interest mechanisms from through the federal government.
Okay, so it's totally something different, and it's not designed for smaller businesses that have independent contractors working for them and those kind of things and looking for a little relief. That's not the area to look for that kind of relief.
Through the chair, correct. That would be the Small Business Administration.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Do we have any other questions regarding the programs?
Yeah, Neil, this is Andy Josephson. Can I try another one with Ms. Pitney, please?
Sure. Representative Josephson.
So, and this sort of relates, Ms. Pitney, back to what Co-Chair Johnson, I think, was talking about. When there was discussion, for example, of paid for the $100 billion for grants to hospitals and Medicaid receiving institutions, if some of those are direct grants that we wouldn't automatically have jurisdiction over, will we either during some session that occurs during the current calendar year or by January, be privy to that information? I mean, it occurs to me that, you know, in a look to see with limited resources who to give money to for FY22, we may want to say, well, geez, this grantee got a lot of money on their through their own initiative, and so we need to look for other people who didn't. Will we get that sort of information?
And
Johnson?
Yes, through the chair. Some of that information might be coming to us, Representative Josephson, from the reporting requirements that we spelled out in SB 241.
Okay.
Where we are, as the legislature, been asking for reports. And I think some of that we will see, and those will be monthly reports from the administration. Will we see all of it? I'm not sure if we'll see some that are directly from federal to, say, nonprofits, you know, ones that don't go through the state at all, but we should be able to see ones, I think, that are CMS.
Okay, that's helpful. I didn't know if Pat wanted to add anything.
Ms. Pitney?
Nothing to add.
Okay. Are there any questions regarding these programs?
I have another question. This is Representative Ortiz.
Representative Ortiz.
Now I am going to refer back specifically to that same area of the $500 billion on page 9 that we just spoke about. I think there a comment was made by Pat that perhaps some of this money could go for, quote, a larger contribution for into PERS and TERS. Can you elaborate on that? And are the steps in place already for us to do that? And or is there any sort of legislative role that, for that to happen?
So, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, several years ago, there was a pension obligation bond piece of legislation that was passed, and then it was not utilized by the administration. That particular piece of legislation exists, but it exists as a pension obligation bonds, which would be where it would be sold directly by the state. So this one would require another piece of legislation to allow it to be you know, essentially a transaction between the state and the federal government. So it would require a piece of legislation, and it would require authority, but it works similarly to the pension obligation bond legislation that is currently in place, that would have to be adjusted. And And maybe, I think it's limited right now to $1.7 billion, and it, you know, could be increased. But really, it comes down to what would be the financing terms, and is that worthwhile?
Okay, thank you for that. Obviously, a question for a little bit later on down the road then.
I believe so, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
yes,
this is Kathy.
This is Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Okay, and we had
go ahead and let,
we've got
go ahead and let Colleen go first.
Okay, I should Representative Sullivan Leonard and then Representative Hilton.
Hi, good morning. Hey, just a quick question, because I don't actually have formulas before me with how the federal government has lined out how the CARES Act is to be dispersed within the states, if you will. Do we have particular formulas that we have been given with how these funds are to be dispersed specifically?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, there are, I don't know, 100 or more provisions in the CARES Act. And some of the provisions come with a particular formula distribution. For instance, the Education Stabilization Fund. has a formula distribution to the different states. The big piece of funding, that Corona Relief Fund, that $1.25 billion, right now the only guidance that exists is that it needs to be used for unanticipated expenses related to the COVID preparation and mitigation and response. So there's nothing that has a formula attached to that 1.25 other than Alaska will receive 1.25, and we anticipate that that deposit will happen by the 24th of April, and the deposit will be into the state treasury.
Right. Okay, and that's what I'm looking for. So we have funds that will be coming through approximately April 24th, and partly what I'm looking at is what Senator Murkowski has just pointed out, where with the Coronavirus Relief Fund, they're looking at around $88 million for tribal entities, and so they are now waiting for particular calculations for that distribution. And so I guess my question is, are we kind of putting the cart before the horse? Should we not be waiting for further guidelines before going down the list of what may or may not be distributed? And then also then we'd be able to ask many of the questions that have been brought forward today.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leavener, I think there are a lot of questions yet to be answered, and there will be a lot of moving parts. And I think the timing of when certain things will be addressed will be there. The $88 million that Senator Murkowski was talking about is separate and apart from the $1.25 billion that's coming to the state of Alaska?
Yeah, very good. And really what I was looking for was just how it would be distributed and how funds are being calculated. So I'll wait and listen to Megan Wallace and ask further questions then. Thank you.
And Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. On the page 10, when you were talking about the 1.25, I'm feeling like there might be something missing that has to do with an economic impact effect. Have you heard anything about that?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, the economic, this particular fund, the Corona Relief Fund, is really focused at through this piece of legislation on unanticipated expenditures related to the COVID response. And if you recall, in the budgets that passed, there was funding for the public health division plus what we call open-ended federal receipt authority in the public health arena for response for the COVID outbreak, you know, mitigation, preparation, response, reaction. So to the degree that federal money and state money is spent directly in the public health arena, that the state has, or the administration has that authority at this point in time. So for the public health response, our budget accommodated use of this funds for the public health response. The economic response, to the degree that this federal money can be used for that, is not part of the budget at this time.
And Chair, just to follow up on that, just for clarification, the receipt authority, the unlimited receipt authority, if I remember correctly, was in the mental health trust budget that we passed, and that was passed before the CARES Act was enacted. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I believe you're correct.
Okay. Do we have any further questions?
Yeah. Can I ask the second question, please?
Sure. Representative Chilton.
Thank you. Just going back to the dollars, the stimulus dollars being sent, do you have – I've heard about 40,000 Alaskans would not qualify for that. Have you heard any update of that number? Do you have any idea how many may not qualify because it's based on your 2018-2019 tax return?
Through the chair, Representative, I do not have any information on that number.
And just to follow up, Representative Pilton, there have been a number of outlines on that, and folks like that are on Social Security, it's mainly anybody that has direct deposit, some form of direct deposit from the federal government will receive their checks. So folks that are on Social Security but have not filed a tax return, they will receive their checks. And yes, there will be checks coming out later in the year, and they're saying that it might take a while to track down everybody that deserves these checks or is supposed to be getting these checks that are not on a direct deposit. But I understand from the federal government that they're working hard on getting that out as quickly as possible. And if you know anybody that is either not – does not have a direct deposit with the federal government, the Department of Treasury has now put a portal on where you can apply for your $1,200 check and $500 check per child. Off the top of my head, I can't find – I don't have it on this iPad, but I can get it to you later if that would be helpful.
Well, thank you. I'm moving on to just another question. There was a group of contractor type or people who are doing Uber or Lyft or that kind of thing, that there was a program, an unemployment program, you had mentioned, I believe that just talking with Department of Labor, that 3 to 4 weeks out before that, so like for more of the self-employed type of people, could you talk about that just a little bit?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, yes, it's my understanding that both from on the federal side and then on the state technology coding side, that's a few weeks out yet, but to the degree that somebody applies, then they would be first in line when the systems are set up. But yes, it will take some time.
So, follow up on that. So, if somebody applies in advance, it won't. What happened? My understanding, what happened with the unemployment was people that applied before the bill, I think it's 308, was signed, actually got kicked out or letters back because it hadn't changed those guidelines yet. So if somebody applies for this expanded program early and say they apply for it now, they would just be getting in line and it wouldn't cause them to be kicked out of the system?
That is my understanding. And it would probably be worth that the person requesting clarity from the Department of Labor.
Okay. And then I have one last follow-up question, or it's not a follow-up, a new question, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Representative Chilton.
Thank you. And lastly, my question was just regarding assisted living and congregate meals and things like that. Those were federal programs you had discussed, I believe, on page 6 maybe. Are those things that would be going to directly to those organizations, or would that be something coming through the state, or do you have any idea of how those have worked?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, those are grant programs from federal agencies, and unless the grant program was a consolidated statewide request for proposals, my understanding it would be each individual operator would apply. But it would really be based on the provisions of the grant that the federal agency sends out.
Okay, thank you. So it basically would be up to those particular providers to be checking into those to find out what things that they can apply for and qualify for.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Do we have any other questions from anyone? Hearing no. Oh, sure. Representative Wu.
Now I got to find what page it's on. It has to do with the municipal distribution of communities over 500,000. Alaska doesn't have any, obviously, but I guess if the act, I mean, it says the act allowed for 45% set aside. Does that, if let's say Alaska had one city at 500,000 and then everyone else dispersed over smaller communities, that one city would in fact get 45% or would be allowed to get 45%? And as it stands now, since there are no communities over 500, does that mean there's no obligation at all to disperse funds to any of the localities, any of the municipalities? I mean, not saying it wouldn't happen, but as it is, since there's not one community with over 500,000, then there's no obligation for any percentage of this money to go to municipalities.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, there's an expectation, you know, based on the provisions of the act, that the state then would, it was in a sense a management issue. The federal government didn't want to manage smaller chunks of money. There's an expectation that there would be assistance to local governments. But it really is up to the state to then manage that. And the 45%, I don't know exactly how that would have calculated out on a kind of a per $500,000 population center. But what the math was based on was this the macroeconomics of state versus local government. And that's what the 45% kind of target was established by. So there's an expectation, there's not necessarily an obligation.
Follow-up.
And then it'd be the state's responsibility to manage it.
Follow-up.
Sure. So I guess what I'm understanding is that the municipality had over 500,000, then the federal government would assume that they have sort of the management skills to disperse, distribute, or use a large chunk of money, whereas if they're a smaller municipality, then the federal government will give the money to the state, who will then decide how to distribute it to the municipalities and so forth. So it's that a larger city would have the infrastructure capacity to handle a large chunk of money, whereas a smaller, under 500,000, is considered small, and therefore the feds are just going to give to the state with the assumption that it goes out to local governments.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I think it's a little bit as you portrayed it, but it's also that the federal government did not want to have to manage at at a smaller level, because that's a huge overhead for them as well.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any other questions? I'm sorry, was that Representative Josephson? Okay, well, hearing no. Oh, who is, and I'm sorry, who's this?
Andy Josephson.
Okay, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. Pitney. Could the testing that is covered by the CARES Act at the bottom of page 3, it's your last PowerPoint bullet there, could that be used for the testing of fish process workers and other fishing industry personnel?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this testing this requires if you are an insurance provider,
okay,
or if, like, for state employees, we have Alaska Care, that insurance plan covers COVID testing. So to the degree that a fisher person had that, then that could cover it. I think a better provision would be in the health mitigation and response through the public health component, set up a testing system that would allow a safer ability for fishermen in that area.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Hearing no further questions, Megan Wallace, if you could go ahead and start off with what you got there.
Sure. For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. I wanted to focus my comments and follow up to Ms. Pitney's presentation to focus mainly on the legal issues surrounding expenditure of the CARES Act funds, which is primarily appropriation issues. Please note that, you know, my comments are really preliminary guidance because as there are proposals released by the executive branch or there are appropriations considered by the legislature, each of those proposals will need to be specifically analyzed with respect to the purpose and the federal dollars that are attached to the use of those funds. But to start on a more big picture scale, the funds that we have been discussing today are federal funds, and just like all other federal funds that come from the federal government, they come with restrictions attached as to what those funds can be used on. So I'm going to focus my comments largely on the last group of CARES Act dollars that we've been most recently discussing, which are the Section 5001 $1.25 billion payment that is expected to be received by the state of Alaska here shortly. And as the slide that was in Ms. Pitney's presentation indicates, Section 5001 of the CARES Act does specifically set out what the restrictions on these federal funds are. And in general, as Pat said, it's just that they are used to cover costs of qualifying COVID-19 expenses. And so our guidance at this point from the U.S. Treasury Department doesn't go much beyond that. Which makes specific analysis as to how to use these funds across, you know, maybe departments or state programs outside of the Department of Health and Social Services a tricky analysis to do. And part of the reason that careful analysis and consideration should be given is that Section 5001 does contain oversight authority, and the Inspector General of the Department of Treasury does have oversight, monitoring, and basically an audit function to make sure that expenditure of though the funds that are received by the state under this provision, the $1.25 billion, are spent in compliance with the use of funds provision, which is that they're necessary expenditures for the COVID-19 emergency. And if it's later determined that the state did not use the funds for that purpose, there is the risk that the state will be forced to repay those amounts. So once these funds hit the state treasury, as you know, under Article 9, Section 13 of the Alaska Constitution, that money cannot be withdrawn from this treasury without an appropriation. So in other words, that these, before the CARES Act funds can be expended, they must have been appropriated. So in my opinion, there's three main options for expenditure of these CARES Act funds. First, the first option would be that the legislature reconvene and specifically appropriate the money that's received by the CARES Act. Alternatively, if the money is not specifically appropriated, the administration would have to look at existing appropriation provisions and find either open-ended federal receipt authority or other receipt authority that would allow for expenditure of these funds within the confines of that specific appropriation. And the third option would be for the governor to seek to utilize the RPL process to increase other federal appropriations in the budget where the legislature had not previously appropriated those federal receipts. The legislature obviously has not yet specifically appropriated any CARES Act funds, so I'll move into discussing maybe some potential appropriations that exist in our current budgetary scheme that potentially could be utilized for expenditure of these CARES Act funds. One of those provisions was mentioned by Pat in the mental health budget, which was passed early this year and included some supplemental COVID-19 emergency funding. In the mental health budget, there was open-ended, which means there was not a set amount of federal receipts, but rather whatever amount of federal receipts that were received during FY20, which is a period between from July 1st, 2019 through June 30th, 2020. So that would capture the moment in time that the $1.25 billion is expected to be deposited, that it gave open authority to the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health Emergency Programs, expenditure authority specifically, though, to respond for responding to and mitigating the risk of the COVID-19 outbreak. So there lies one potential appropriation for expenditure of these funds, and another area for potential expenditure, but I will qualify that I'm not sure the funds will actually be deposited into the disaster relief fund. So obviously the governor and the president have declared the COVID-19 public health disaster, and the legislature has extended the governor's declaration of a disaster until November 15th, 2020. And as part of the governor's authority to expend funds in response to a disaster, the governor has some authority to expend money from the disaster relief fund. But in the COVID-19 disaster financing plan that was enacted as part of SB 241, the legislature specifically limited the governor's expenditure limit from the disaster relief fund to a cumulative total of $10 million of the assets of the disaster relief fund. So in other words, notwithstanding how much money is ultimately deposited into the disaster relief fund, the governor would only have authority to expend $10 dollars of the assets of that fund, whether they be state funds or federal receipt authority. And I would concur with Pat's statements that while the legislature contemplated and provided broad authority for the administration to respond to the COVID-19 disaster from a public health standpoint, there is does not appear to be other appropriations that would specifically allow for expenditure of the CARES Act funds for economic response absent some other action by the legislature, and that would either be the first option, which I talked about, which would be that the legislature specifically appropriate the funds for those purposes, and we would still be bound by whatever federal guidance there is in terms of appropriate use and whether economic response was sufficiently related to the COVID-19 disaster, or secondarily, use of the RPL process. And for those that may be listening or those who may not be familiar with what the RPL process is that the RPL process is it's a process that is described in the Executive Budget Act, Alaska Statute 3707080H, which is typically used during the interim, allows the governor to submit a request to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to seek to increase an appropriation item based on the receipt of additional federal program receipts that were not specifically appropriated by the full legislature. In this circumstance, while we're not technically in the interim, the full legislature has appropriated or has already passed the budgets for the upcoming fiscal year, including the supplemental budget, the operating budget, the mental health budget. And so it may be a process that could be utilized in these circumstances, given the legislature's indefinite recess at this point. But as I mentioned, 3707080, subsection H, allows the governor to submit a request to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and to seek that a specific appropriation item be increased based on these additional funds. And the way that the legislature allows for this is that there is specific language that is traditionally included in the operating budget that then appropriates those additional federal receipts based on compliance with the program requirements under 3707080H. And both the FY20 and the FY21 Alaska operating budget do contain this appropriation language. And I can read for you what that those appropriations say in pertinent part. And they say that the federal receipts that exceed those amounts appropriated by this act, and by this act means the operating budgets, are appropriated conditioned on compliance with the program review provisions of 3707080H. And so long as the administration complies with the program review provisions, then the appropriations may be increased. And there's generally a lot of questions in terms of whether LBNA can approve those the request to increase the appropriation, or whether they have the power to decline the appropriations. And the program is specifically set out that the governor submits an RPL to LBNA and then must wait 45 days before expenditures commence. And LBNA could reject the proposal, and then the governor is required to come back and provide written guidance as to why the governor wants to move forward with expenditures, notwithstanding the LBNA's recommendation against the program, but ultimately the governor would have the authority to move forward with the RPL, even if LBNA does not approve expenditure under the RPL request. So in this instance, the legislature has already appropriated the money, and the RPL process is used to simply increase the amount of appropriation. It's not an appropriation itself. It's just an attempt or a way or a mechanism to increase the amount of federal funds that have already been appropriated by the full legislature. And LBNA serves just as an oversight and an advisory role to know that that increase has been requested and that the administration plans to expend those funds. It would be my opinion that with respect to these CARES Act funds, that the most strictest interpretation of 3707080H is that the language in the operating budget that supplements this RPL statutory process allows for money that in excess of the federal receipts that have been appropriated to be increased. In this case, the legislature has not specifically appropriated any CARES Act funds. And so there is an argument that the RPL process is not appropriate to be used to increase any appropriation to utilize expenditure of the CARES Act funds. A little bit less restrictive interpretation of 3707080H would be that the RPL process could be used to seek to increase appropriations where the legislature has appropriated some federal funds, but that those appropriations should be increased to accept these additional federal funds, albeit different category of federal funds, for expenditure in accordance with that specific appropriation. But it would be my opinion that 3707080H or the RPL process could not be used to increase an appropriation where the legislature did not appropriate any federal funds.
Thank you. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I'd like to try a real-life situation here so I can get my head and my arms around this. Since there seemed to be legislative intent that some of this funds go to local governments and that the smaller governments, you know, the federal government didn't want to have the management costs, so it becomes a cost of the state or the responsibility of the state, we currently have in statute basically our community revenue sharing statute. I can't tell you which one it is, you know, the number of the statute. But I'm not sure with that fund, and that fund is always a third of it is spent out of whatever is deposited, and it was $60 million last year. It's I can't remember I think it was vetoed, so it's probably $60 million this year. But the third of whatever's in the fund is expended out in a formula. Would putting funds into that fund, would that be gray area as we get into the RPL, or is that something that could be done?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, in my opinion, utilizing the RPL process for community assistance would not be appropriate because those funds or that appropriation only had state dollars that were appropriated. At this point, I'd have to pull up the exact vetoes, but
to the extent that the governor vetoed the entire community assistance appropriation, that appropriation would not be eligible to be increased anyways because it is no longer an enacted appropriation in the operating budget. So the only, even if you were to attempt to use the RPL process, you couldn't use that as your mechanism to increase because that appropriation no longer exists because of the veto. What the legislature could do is that if it saw a need to send out this federal funds to assist in communities, is that it could enact a new appropriation, which and instead of using state funds, it could use these CARES Act federal receipts and distribute those funds out to communities. And while it wouldn't be an appropriation to carry out necessarily the specific statutory program, the legislature could look at that statutory program as guidance in terms of evaluating, you know, what is an appropriate amount of funds to send out to those communities.
Thank you. A follow-up. For another example, we have Alaska Housing, and their budget has included a number of items that some of the other funds, other than $1.25 billion, could be funneled to. Do you see Alaska Housing being able to act independently of the legislature as far as receiving some of those funds? Or, again, will that be something that we need to consider?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, you know, I know that Pat spoke about some HUD funds that might be available. I'd have to get back to you. I don't know enough about the expenditure and budgetary process that's used for Alaska Housing to speak in terms of whether they independently could, you know, depending on if they got federal receipts directly from the government, whether those would need to be appropriated. I suspect they would, but I'd have to get back to you on that. Maybe Pat would have an answer for you.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston. So AHFC has several federal appropriations in different programs. The way they could act independently is to the degree that they have receipt authority that's over and above what they normally get. So let's say they had federal receipt authority of $10 million, and over the last 3 years, they've only gotten about $5 million each year, and so they would have that difference between $5 and $10 million to use the new funds that would be available. To the degree that the federal funds available in the CARES Act exceeds their federal receipt authority, then that is one that would be more likely available in an RPO. But again, you'd want to see what federal funds there were and what existing federal appropriations they've had before you could say for certain that it was an appropriate process. But that is, I would say, more likely a more appropriate use than what community assistance would be or ability to do it through an RPO.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes, I hate to ask so many, Mr. Co-Chair, but I have a couple questions.
Representative Josephson.
Two areas of inquiry that have just been brought up. So in the first one, we were talking about the RPL process generally, and I did my homework and reviewed that again before the hearing. And I think what I heard Ms. Wallace say is that, for example, if we had an appropriation item for apples, and the CARES Act provided additional money for apples, and we decided we didn't need any more apples, the governor could issue an RPL and say, we're going to do it, and we would have 45 days to offer comment, and if he didn't like what we said, he could ignore our opinion. But if there was nothing on pomegranates in our budget, because we'd never taken up that kind of fruit, he couldn't submit an RPL for pomegranates. Do I have that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that, you know, generally that's correct. And so you cannot use the RPL process to spend money that has not been appropriated. And so, you know, what is really difficult in this current situation is, you know, Pat had a 16-page write-up of potential funding that might be available. And so there might be a lot of categories, you know, education is one of them, Medicaid is one of them, you know, unemployment insurance is one of them, where, you know, we know that there's federal funds that are going to be available, and maybe because of this act, there's more money available than we anticipated, and therefore the RPL process is appropriate. But to the extent that we want to use these funds on programs that do not have any federal funding attached to them, the RPL process is not an appropriate mechanism to use to expend those funds without additional legislative appropriation.
Okay, that's very helpful. And a follow-up, please.
Follow-up?
As to the vetoes from now 9 days ago, Ms. Wallace, you made reference to them and talked about whether we could use federal dollars to replace them. But I guess I'm confused because I thought because we passed House Bill 205 after March 27th, we pretend as if we never passed it at all, that our focus is on the mental health budget that we passed in March, I guess, and also on the budgets we passed last summer. Am I wrong about that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So the restriction piece from the CARES Act of Section 5001, which again only applies to the $1.25 billion lump sum payment that the state of Alaska is going to utilize, the requirements for use of those funds in subsection D of that section says that the funds, there's three categories of restrictions, and the first is that they be, you know, related to costs incurred for COVID-19, and then the second is that they were not accounted for in the budget that was most recently passed. And so I think that we get a little bit of loss in the semantics of what budgets did the CARES Act apply to and which budgets are we talking about. But the reason that the appropriations that maybe the governor recently vetoed are relevant is because in subsection 3 of the CARES Act, in terms of the restrictions, it says that it allows for the funds to be used on costs that were incurred from March 1st until December 30th. And so for us in Alaska, that covers two different fiscal years. That covers what we're in now, which is the supplemental FY20, and then next year's budget, the FY21 budget, which would be a topic that's relevant to the governor's vetoes. And so we still have to appropriate these federal receipts. And so if you're using the RPL process, and you're looking at expenditure of FY20, of expenditure in FY20, you're going to have to look at appropriations that were made in the FY20 budget. But if you're looking for expenditures that are going to happen in FY21, which is after July, you would have to use an appropriation that was approved for FY21. And so it is a little bit confusing, but that's the reason why at least specific to the RPL process and whether or not the RPL process is appropriate, that's why we have to look at both budgets.
Okay, I mean, just a quick comment. That your statement is helpful. It supports, it seems to me, sort of the governor's position broadly,
that never you mind, we will use, in other words, relax, we will use these CARES monies to supplant my vetoes. But anyway, thank you.
Do we have any further questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Ortiz.
Representative Ortiz.
So, Megan, the question is, you put forward three main options that we have to potentially appropriate the $1.25 billion of expected monies that we expect to come in sometime around April 21st, I think it was. Is it safe to say that if we set aside the the safety issues in relationship to reconvening for the legislature to come back and reconvene in a physical sense in Juneau, setting aside that issue, is it safe to say that the cleanest and perhaps most efficient way of appropriating that money would be for the legislature to reconvene and appropriate that money? Is that safe in assuming that's what you're – that's – is that a safe assumption or an accurate assumption?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, you know, that's certainly a policy call for the legislature, but if we talk about risks involved, as we can see from this discussion today, there's a lot of unknowns. But what the legislature and what the state does know is that the state will receive a minimum $1.25 billion from the federal government. And so if we want to take out the speculation or confusion in terms of authority to expend those monies, yes, the simplest thing to do would be for the legislature to specifically appropriate the $1.25 billion. And then there's no confusion in terms of who has the authority and where those funds go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do we have any further questions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, Rep. Sullivan Leonard. I have a question with regard to RPL. Just trying to, like Representative Josephson, kind of do my homework with past history of RPL. And I see it has been used in past for emergency funding for National Guard, Medicaid, et cetera. I'm looking at a legal piece that Ms. Wallace had responded to Senator Bill Welikowski. And when you look at limitations of the RPL process for expenditures for the CARES Act funds, they talked about appropriation items, for example, that come from additional federal receipts. But it also refers to other program receipts. So I guess my question is to Megan Wallace is, if we look at other program receipts, for example, would you consider PCE then the program receipt then that disbursed funds for the community revenue sharing? And would that apply then to the RPL?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, no. Additional program receipts are would be a scenario where a program receives additional revenue that the legislature had not anticipated. So a program that maybe is more successful or there's been more fees collected than the legislature had initially anticipated or appropriated, the RPL process could then be utilized. For example, you know, if a program collected more licensure fees than they anticipated and then wanted to expend those fees for the program, the RPL process is would be an appro- you could use that to increase program receipts. PCE funds are in a state fund, and so those wouldn't be additional program receipts. Utilization of the funds in that fund would have to be specifically appropriated by the legislature. The RPL process couldn't be used to request to expend additional funds out of a state fund, only to increase program receipts.
Okay, very good. I guess just for the record, I just
really just want to say that, you know, my hopes are that funding can get dispersed from the state through the administration down to the local government as soon as possible. I know that people, for example, in my district are really hurting. We've got businesses that are closing. They've got property tax to pay to the extent of greater than $80,000 due very soon. And my hopes are that we're not going to hold up the process, that we move this quickly, swiftly, and effectively to those that are most affected in our particular areas. And anyway, I just wanted to end on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan Leonard. Do we have any further questions? And hearing no further questions, Representative Johnson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. And from today's presentation, I can't echo Representative Sullivan Leonard's comments enough. I think we are definitely at a point where we all need to work well together and work in an expedient manner to get these funds out to the state in the most thoughtful manner. I think all of us are realizing that this is not something that's going to go away in a week or in a month, and it might take years to recover. So I think we need to reach out to the administration, say that we are here and we're willing to help, and we want to see Alaska move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnston. The intent of this meeting is the goal, and I think along that path, you know, we wanted to get the discussion going. We want folks to be able to ask the questions. I know there's a lot of gray areas and a lot of confusion as to, how this is all going to be implemented. And we just want to figure out what we do know and what we don't know. And as we move forward, I think we can all kind of put our heads together and figure this out. So with that said, the time now is 11:56 a.m., and we will be adjourned. Thank you very much.